You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Perdita Finn. Perdita, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Brainerd. It's wonderful to be here.
So, Perdita, it's November 5th. This is the publication date of your book, and I want to ask you what you're working on now, but I imagine it's the promotion of the book, or are there other things? Tell me what's in your sphere, and of course we'll talk about the book.
Well, the book that comes out today, it's our birthday, is the book I co-wrote with my husband, author Clark Strand. It's called The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine, Hidden in the Rosary. And this book is really not just a book, it's helped create an international community and an international movement connecting the rights of women with the rights of Earth, the Earth. And so I've been doing a lot of writing. I do, I write for our community and blog posts. I write for a lot of magazines. I'm doing a lot of promotional writing for the book. But to call it promotional writing isn't entirely accurate. There's just a lot of storytelling that needs to be done right now to help the voices of the earth and the plants and the animals be heard.
And okay, so this is that's kind of the meta view of this whole project.
It is
an engaged project spiritually and in terms of activism and feminism.
Yes.
About, you could say, healing the planet, to take the very big picture, right?
You got it.
So to get into it, either a story or to get a little more, micro in detail about this, yeah, do you want to tell a story? It could be kind of one of the, like, miracle stories from this, so people start understanding what the Way of the Rose is about, or something else.
Sure. I mean, I was raised without any religion. I got to be a real child of the 60s. I was raised by Bohemian atheists. So I was raised, and my older brother was a Buddhist, and, I grew up in a world of psychoanalysis and Buddhism and the Beats, and the last thing in the whole world I ever thought I'd find myself doing was praying the rosary like my little old Irish Catholic grandmother, but I didn't come to it via Christianity. I found myself as a young mother, and I tried to start a children's program at a Zen Buddhist monastery. I got kicked out of the Zendo for trying to nurse in the Zendo with my child. And then I found my way to a liberal, very liberal, progressive Protestant church. And again, I found myself in a back room with all the kids talking with them. And I thought, enough of this, And, both the Buddhists and the Christians are always hitting you up for donations anyway. And I was done with that, and I was done with priests and monks of all kinds. And for reasons I've written a whole nother book after this one to explain, I found myself wanting to pray the rosary, and I was utterly embarrassed by that. I thought, I don't know any other sort of feminist ex-Buddhists who pray the rosary, and I figured I never would. Well, to make a long story short, there are now thousands of people all over the world praying the rosary like this, who've begun to discover that, in fact, the rosary is much older than Christianity, and it really connects us.
Let me ask you something, but before you say that, let me just ask you, you said,
sure.
And then you suddenly just wanted to pray the rosary. From the background that you had, suddenly just wanting to praise the rosary doesn't seem like something that would come to you. I have a background that's not too dissimilar from yours in some respects. I had Bohemian upbringing and somewhat in parents who were teachers. I wouldn't come to me to say, I'd like to pray the rosary, and, that's just alien to me completely.
I know. Well, it was as alien to me as it would be to you, and so I think what you hear me hurrying over is that even that still little, like, trace amount of astonishment and bewilderment. I was a young mother, and we tell the story in the book. And we were on a plane with our two children. My son was a year. My daughter was four. And the plane nearly crashed. And I don't know if you've ever been on a plane that nearly crashes, but it is absolutely terrifying. The plane dropped like a rock out of the sky. And it wasn't like there were any protocols that were followed. The stewardesses were screaming and crying and praying, and luggage was flying everywhere. And my daughter reached out to me and said, "Mommy, Mommy, are we going to die?" And I thought the answer was yes. And, you know, what do you say to your child in that moment? And I said the only thing that was in my heart, which is, "I'm not going to let you go. Whatever happens, I'm not letting you go." And somehow, in the midst of all that, the plane got on the ground. There were ambulances everywhere, men in Mylar suits. No one ever told us what had happened. They put us on another plane and sent us on our way. It was, without question, one of the most terrifying experiences of my life.
Oh, my God.
After that experience, I couldn't shake that feeling of relentless descent. And it sort of tapped into a feeling I had begun to have about the world and where we're headed as a species and in our culture.
Relentless
right
descent,
now.
As in, that's more an expanded view, but I mean, definition of that, but you're talking about like the descent the plane took. Also.
Yeah. It feels to me like we're headed towards the crash. And
right.
I think a lot of climate scientists feel that way. And I was certainly reading climate science back in the 90s. And there was a kind of existential anxiety that this experience awakened in me. And I can only say that I was reaching out for something to hold on to. I couldn't hold on to nothingness. It's hard to let go. If you've ever gone rock climbing, it's hard to let go if you don't have something to hold on to. And I honestly have to say, I've written my next book is all about this. I do believe that I think I've prayed the rosary in past lives. I must have had some DNA in it. My Irish Catholic forebears were speaking to me. I cannot tell you why I wanted to pray it. But what I found was that it was the perfect practice spiritually for a young mother. And it was, I began to discover that it gave me worry beads, you know. Why does every religion have a tradition of worry beads? Because there's a lot to worry about. And if you're a parent, you've got a lot to worry about. And so I just began to explore the spiritual practice. And I used all the spiritual tools I had, from studying koans in a Zen monastery to what I'd learned about centering prayer to ancestor practice that I was studying with people like Maladoma Somme, an African elder. And all of these teachings informed my experience of the rosary, but the rosary brought them together in an entirely new way. And what I began was a journey to discover, like, what was this practice? And what I found was that it's way, way older than Christianity. And that began a discovery that was really exciting into sort of lost feminine spiritual practices that we really, really have lost a relationship to.
It's fascinating. So okay. I mean, it's fascinating and it seems crazy, you know, in a sense. Right? My wife, who's, you know, from Spain and a Catholic,
uh-huh.
You know, I remember when I first talked to her about this, and she said, "I don't understand it at all. You know, the rosary, yeah, everybody does the rosary." But that's not how you're talking about it, right? And she's, you know, kind of a recovering Catholic, as we would say in America, you know.
Totally.
So
we have a lot of recovering Catholics in our group.
But that's very different from the way she was brought up with the rosary and the way you're doing the rosary, right? Or no?
Well, here's the interesting thing. I'm reminded of a guy in our group. He was he's of Sicilian American heritage, and when he was a little boy, his old Italian grandmother lived with them. And one day, he came into a room, and she was sitting on the edge of her bed, and she was praying with her beads. And she had this black Madonna in the room, and he said to her, sort of as a child will, innocently, "Is that the Virgin Mary?" And this old Sicilian grandmother shrugged and said, "I don't know." These old women knew stuff. And they had passed it down mother to daughter, grandmother to granddaughter, in a culture that was actively oppressing them. And so a lot of what we're trying to recover is the oral tradition of these women who were hiding what they knew in plain sight while the church was actively trying to take it away from them.
Hmm.
Now, you know, if your wife is from Spain, you can go back and back in Spain to some of the oldest Paleolithic sites. And they found there, in these places where there's been devotion to the lady, it goes back to Mary, and then it goes back to other figures who are much older than Christianity, back to Paleolithic goddess figurines that are found. And that there's a kind of direct inheritance that the rosary leads us sort of like through the labyrinth of our history, back and back and back. Beads are very old. Beads have been found in Morocco from 100,000 years ago. It's hard to take in that number.
Go on. Yeah, it is hard to take in that.
Think about it. So if we go back to, you know, the ancient Greeks, they're as far from the ancient Egyptians as we are from the ancient Greeks. But we're still only 5,000 years ago, right? But we're talking 100,000 years ago. There are people, and you go back to those old caves in Spain and France. You go back and look at that art. And Clark and I, part of our book documents our experiences in the Dordogne, going into the caves with a guide to look at that art deep within the earth. These were people with phenomenal experiences of culture. They had art that's as good as our art. They had music and musical instruments that was as interesting as our music, with none of the ills of civilization. And they had it, not for 100 years, not for 1,000 years, but for tens of thousands of years. When we talk about sustainability, we've got to begin looking at our ancestral ways that we've lost. And part of that was that these people, other than axe heads, the thing they were most making were beads. And the question becomes, why beads? And, you know, why beads take a lot of work to make. They're not easy to make. They're very refined. They're very hard. Sometimes you'll find beads in these ancient burial sites. So clearly they were holy objects. Certainly people's experience of beads comes from, you know, as children we know the collecting of women of seeds and nuts and berries. We're very focused these days on meditation in our culture as a spiritual practice. But meditation, in all likelihood, arose from hunting behaviors. You know, the need for radical stillness, to be very quiet, to be very focused, to have your attention riveted so that you know when to act. Let your thoughts go so you can see what's ahead of you. These are all hunting behaviors. But there's this feeling that bead practices, which are ubiquitous around the world in all religions, emerge from the gathering behaviors of women, gathering seeds and nuts and berries. And those gathering behaviors tend to be communal practices. They tend to include lots of storytelling. They tend to include the community of children. You know, you can kind of wrap your beads around your wrist, and you've got counters so you can keep track of the prayers, so you can stop to take care of the kids or take care of an old person or sing a song or kiss somebody's boo-boo. You know what I mean? They're very integrated into daily life, and they're very integrated into community. And the truth is, if you look at indigenous cultures, it's the gatherers who actually feed the community. I mean, it's great to have a mammoth from time to time, and that burst of protein is really essential, but it's that day-to-day gathering that really weaves the community together. And the problem is we've become a culture that privileges hunting and predation. Mm. And we have forgotten these storytelling ways. I think a lot of women right now are very concerned about communities that privilege silence and silencing, because a lot of women have been silenced by religion. And, you know, they will tell us that silence is more valuable than storytelling, just as women are trying to tell the stories of what's happened to them. So, I know I'm trying to put a lot out there. But that's fine.
So, it's good to hear about all this. So then the book, which is coming out and people can find, and there's a link to in this article, is also about, what you're telling me and stories. Is it also about, like, how to do it? Is there, a different method? In a way, of course, I would imagine listeners want to try this to see if it works for them, whatever that means for them.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. real easy how-to. There's very easy how-to stuff in the book. The great thing about the rosary is you don't need a guru. There are no masteries. There are no certificate programs. You don't have to pay a ton of money to anybody. You can learn it in about 5 minutes. You can teach it to your kids at the same time, your four-year-old. We pray it in the traditional way, but we certainly don't understand it traditionally. But again, I would say that I think the women of the Middle Ages did not understand it the way that conventional Catholics understand it in the modern era. The Catholic Church has done a great deal to try and kill the rosary, actually.
Hmm. And how did you find this kind of, how did the community find this authentic way of presenting or practicing the rosary?
Well, you know, it's so interesting. So many streams come together in this book. As I mentioned, my husband and I have both been interested in climate science for a long time. And we both have been interested in is there any spiritual response to climate change? How can religion, which has participated in the domination of nature, come up with an answer? So that's been an interest of ours. We've been very interested in spiritual and religious history. We've both been students of it. So much comes into that. We've done a lot of archaeological work. We've read a lot of the old books. We both were English majors with focusing on medieval literature as college kids. So, you know, all these different strands have come together. So we've gone back and read all the old medieval folk tales, legends. There's only been one other book in history about the rosary as a non-Catholic experience. It was a brilliant book written in the 1960s by a Jungian analyst who was the translator of Kafka, and she wasn't Catholic. And she became, like us, devoted to the rosary. And she thought, she looked around her in the 1960s and said, oh, my God, these women are waking up. They're going to all start praying the rosary. They're going to get it. Well, that didn't happen, as we know. Everybody kind of went. We left one patriarchy in Christianity and Judaism and went to another in Buddhism and Hinduism. But there are ways that exist, and I hope this time is now, that it's time, you know, it's time for a return for different ways of knowing and being in the world.
And it's so interesting, and so I'm excited you both wrote this book, and I hope it reaches all the people that it needs to reach, of course. And
I hope it reaches your wife.
Yeah, I think so too.
That's the person I'm talking to in this interview. I always feel like every time I talk to someone, there's one person for whom this book is for. And so my hope is your wife will read it.
I hope so too. That's interesting. And so is there anything else you want to say or a story you want to mention or anything before I ask you the last question? I know there's so much we could talk about in this book. There are so many stories you've told. You said before that, you know, you see yourselves as devoted to the rosary. What does that mean in terms of daily practice? Because when people talk about being devoted to meditation, it's usually an amount of time, but not always. With the rosary, like, when are you doing it and how often, if I can ask?
Well, here's the thing. When I was a young mother, I mostly turned to the rosary, you know, when life went belly up. You know, oh, my God, I would forget, you know, I had dying parents. I had, a mother who was dying in my home. You know, when did I pray the rosary? I prayed the rosary when I was in the ambulance with her. When did I pray the rosary? I prayed the rosary when I was, you know, my kid was weeping unconsolably and wouldn't tell me what was the matter. I prayed the rosary when, you know, it looked like our house might go into foreclosure. You know, I prayed in those moments of extremity. But these days, I think I pray more out of joy and gratitude. And, I mean, certainly I still have plenty of things I need help with. But I find these days that prayer kind of defines my life because I feel I have a lot more buoyancy. The rosary has taught me how to bear witness to sorrow, to really look at it and not be frightened of it. It gives you a tremendous amount of courage in the face of the horrors of the world because it moves you through that sorrow to the joys and to the miracles on either side of it. And so when you begin to really feel that energy and move, the rosary begins to teach you how to move with the natural seasons and rhythms of life. So, I mean, I don't want any shoulds with the rosary. I think it all should come from love. My husband wrote a book about called Meditation Without Gurus, where he was trying to get people to meditate, not because they were supposed to, but because they really wanted to. But most people I know meditate the way they go to the gym, you know, because they think it's good for them. And it's probably better to do all these things because we love them and to start from a place of love. You know, better to hold your beads from a place of love than do five rosaries out of obedience and duty. So, you know, I would say what I do, but I've given my life to this, so I pray a lot. You know, and Clark and I pray together a lot because it's a lot of fun, and we pray with our kids. I mean, I have a daughter with a terrible genetic condition, and prayer has been what has gotten us through that experience. So I do a lot of prayer.
And prayer means what? That together, because it's so alien to me, but prayer means what? To pray together, to do this together means you're,
we say the
you're
rosary.
Sitting there and you're,
yeah,
you're
we say
doing
it
the
out
rosary,
loud.
You're repeating it together. And how long does it take? It's short.
You know, if you do it really fast, you can do it in 10 minutes, which is great. And then you sound like you're purring because you go so fast. It's amazing. The word for mantra, one of the oldest words for mantra in Tibet is the same word for purring. And I love that, because what happens when you start to say the rosary, and one of the oldest words for rosary is japa mala, which means muttering garland. You know, these were muttering, you muttered. And that muttering experience of mantra is very soothing. And it's so soothing that we've discovered that all our animals come when we start to pray, and they want to be on top of us when we pray. So we'll say the rosary, and then we will actually pray out loud for the things we need help with. And unlike yoga class, where you might do your Shiva mantra, you don't expect Shiva to show up. You know what I mean? Nobody in yoga class thinks Shiva's going to walk in the room when we do the Shiva mantra. But my experience, and I think the experience of a lot of people who come to the rosary, is that you begin to experience the lady showing up quite literally in your life, playfully, humorously, surprisingly, miraculously. Yes, the other thing that our book is about is the way that the lady quite literally started showing up in our life. And
this is an experience that's common to many people in the community as well.
Many people report this every day. Every day.
And the prayer itself isn't very long, right? You say 10 minutes, but you're repeating it several times, right?
A rosary consists, in the Middle Ages, the rosary was just the Hail Mary prayer. And that was said 150 times, or as many times as you wanted. In the Middle Ages, the rosary was a folk tradition. It was done by the peasant people, the illiterate people. And it was clearly something they did however they wanted. In fact, you know, one of the great saints of the Catholic Church said, no, the way you pray the rosary is however you want. So there's a lot of freedom. And it became formalized in very interesting ways by adding in Our Fathers. And the Our Fathers became kind of punctuation marks. You would say 10 Hail Marys, and then you would add an Our Father. Say 10 Hail Marys, add an Our Father. They were like markers. But I kind of like the Our Fathers added in, because what happens is you're praying to both the mamas and the papas. And that alchemical energy of male and female, sun and moon, yin and yang, dark and light, you know, that's what kind of brings the whole world back into bloom again. It's what makes everything fertile. And so you're really participating in a kind of alchemical prayer. And also it's an ancestral prayer for ancestral mothers and fathers. And so I like the mothers and fathers. We do have people in our group who prefer not to say the Our Fathers. They're done with patriarchy. They're just doing the Hail Mary. We have people who do it in Sanskrit, Kali, and they do a Kali and Shiva. I mean, there is a lot of diversity when it comes to the rosary, and a lot of fun. So
when you do it, you're keeping in the Our Fathers. You're kind of making up your own how you want to say it.
Well, I say a traditional rosary. Clark and I say a traditional. We could walk into a Catholic church, and the Catholics would think we were saying it just the way you were supposed to. But The reason I have to say we've done that is because there's so much hidden wisdom in that tradition. And that's what we unlock in our book, that this is a kind of Da Vinci code of secrets hidden in plain sight. You know, the old Edgar, is it the Edgar Allan Poe story, the purloined letter, like if you want to hide something, hide it on the table in plain sight. Well, these women hid stuff in the rosary. They hid it all. They hid all their goddess devotion. You know, Wicca was trying to find it, and there it was in the rosary. It was there in the Hail Mary. I mean, I can, you know, I could talk for 5 hours about that. We had to write a 300-page book, and we have another one in us about it. How many secrets were hidden right in plain sight. But, you know, women
and that,
were being...
And that's really what makes it powerful as well, you think, to say these, the traditional Hail Mary even, as, you know, and count your beads and do that. That's what makes it powerful, you're saying, these kind of hidden messages?
Yeah, and you're also aligning yourself with your ancestral mothers and grandmothers. You know, they can hear the prayers. And also I can walk it. It's also, you know, there's always, when we invent something brand new, it's hard to do it with other people because we have to teach it to them, right? And then you start to develop weird orthodoxies and dogma. But if you take something traditional and people kind of work with it to make it work for them, that's a motto of ours, you know, make it work for you, change a word here, change a word there, we find we can harmonize. We're on the same basic track, you know?
Right.
And that's important because, we have created a communities of prayer. There are local fellowships and rosary circles all around the country and in England and France now. And we have phone meetings, and we have a very, very thriving, exciting, wild online community of people who are really interesting. And so it's important to have a way and enough structure for everybody to meet in the same place.
Well, that's very exciting. And, you know, I want to congratulate both of you on the book coming out, and hope the listeners will be able to get a copy of it. And
yeah.
I want to ask you the last question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I don't have the title in front of me, but I am reading the most amazing book on earthworms. Oh, I've got to find the title. And it is so good. I have never learned so much about earthworms. I wish I could find the title. But I didn't know that Darwin's last book was all about the importance of earthworms. And I am fascinated by dirt. You know, Clark, my husband, wrote a book about darkness and the sort of lost experience of darkness. And my next book after Way of the Rose is about the lost experience of dirt and why we need to recover our experience of the dirt.
I like that. I agree with the premise of your book already. Well, thank you again for this talk. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and congratulations on your book.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a wonderful way to celebrate today and celebrate the publication. It's available everywhere. We always tell people, though, do support your local independent bookstores, but the book is available in Kindle and Audible and every way possible. And if you want to join the community, we have a website, wayoftherose.org, and you can find us on Facebook on Way of the Rose, and we're even trying to be on Instagram, hard as it is.
Very good, and there'll be links to that, of course, in this interview.
Great.
Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Brainerd, so much, and blessings to you and your wife.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.